There's an old trope in cartoons, an enormous elephant reduced to a quivering panic at the sight of a mouse. You probably remember that scene from Dumbo. It's played for laughs because why would something so enormous be afraid of something so tiny? Then again, have you ever seen some human completely freak out when a wasp hovers nearby or bat their arms wildly when flies start to swarm the picnic? And as much as we're conditioned to love them, not many people love it when a bee heads their way. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Today we're going to get to know the little flying creatures that hunt and pollinate and sometimes annoy. We'll hear from experts who will explain the intricate dances bees do to communicate food sources and the reason flies rub their tiny little arms. And we'll start off with wasps, whose social lives are complex and dramatic and, sure, sometimes gross, but always fascinating. My first guest has written a delightful book about these creatures, the role they play in the ecosystem, and why they deserve an image makeover. Sarian Sumner is professor of behavioral ecology at University College London, where she studies the ecology and evolution of social insects. Her book is called Endless Forms: The Secret World of Wasps. Let's listen to that conversation from September. Sarian, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
There are a lot more wasps than bees in the world, but there's a lot more information out there about bees than wasps, is that right? Or species of them?
Yeah, there's been a lot more research into bees than there has been into wasps. And there are over 100,000 species of wasps, and there are only across the world. And there are probably 10 times more that haven't been discovered because people don't go out of their way to identify wasps. But bees, there are about 22,000 species. So there are a lot more wasps than bees. And yet the number of research papers on bees outnumber wasps 4-1. And, you know, people like me, wasp researchers, we're kind of a rare breed. There aren't many of us. and I think, you know, one of the reasons why is that we grow up with this culture of learning to fear wasps and learning to only think of them as there's a wasp, I've got to get away from it because it might sting me. And I'm afraid I think that spills into the upbringings of scientists, you know, young scientists as well. And the other reason why I think bees have been better studied than wasps is that we have a really good understanding of what they do in the environment. We know, everybody knows, you just stop a random person on the street and no matter what their interest in biology or the natural world is, they will probably be able to tell you that a bee is important for pollination. And they will tell you that's really important because we need pollination for food and for pretty wildflowers and ecosystems. If you stop somebody on the street and you say, what do wasps do? The odds are that they won't really have an answer. They won't know that wasps, as you said at the beginning of the show, that wasps are nature's pest controllers, that they are regulating the insect populations, the populations of insects that probably species that we dislike almost as much as wasps, like caterpillars that eat our vegetables and, you know, aphids and flies that pester us and pester our crops. So I think it's the reason that we don't really have a good understanding of what wasps do to the same degree that we do of bees.
Bees are actually descended from wasp ancestors. What caused their lineages to diverge?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, so I always like to say that bees are simply wasps that have forgotten how to hunt. They evolved from the crabronids. They basically, so there's a huge swathe of solitary wasps, so the hunting wasps, which are the ones that sting. And the bees are a lineage off that, a whole clade off that, which are basically modified crabronid wasps. And so what drove them to lose the ability to hunt and to exploit pollen? Well, that's a really good question. But the one idea is that it possibly coincided with the emergence of flowering plants, the explosion of speciation of the angiosperms of flowering plants that provided lots more ecological niches that could be exploited. And the gathering of pollen is possibly less less challenging than the paralyzing of prey, because that's what a solitary wasp needs to do. She needs to hunt a live insect or spider or arthropod and sting it, introduce a venom in it which will paralyze it and then take it back to her burrow. So there's a lot of evolutionary honing of natural selection that goes on in order to produce a really effective hunter.
What's the evolutionary benefit of that famous feature, the wasp waste?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So let's go back in evolutionary time and let's look at the origins of the wasps. And the first wasps, because actually all the ants and all the bees, so we talked about the bees a bit, but the ants are also just wasps that have forgotten how to fly. So bees, wasps, bees and ants all evolved from a wasp-like ancestor. And so the wasps are kind of the root of all of these, what we call the Hymenoptera, the bees, wasps, and the ants. But the first wasps arose about 250 million years ago, and they were sawflies or horntails or wood wasps, we sometimes call them. And they actually were vegetarian. So they didn't have a sting, they had an ovipositor, which is an egg-laying sheath. And they would use this to lay their egg inside a plant where there was and the egg would then hatch into a larva and it would eat the plant. So it's a vegetarian life cycle. But then the parasitoid wasps appeared, the carnivorous wasps appeared around 225 million years ago. And those are the parasitoid wasps, which lay their eggs on or inside a caterpillar or a beetle larva, and then the egg will hatch into a larva, and the baby wasp will eat the prey alive from the inside out, which is just beautiful horror story, but also amazing. I know that it's just like the classic horror story, but it is incredible that that could evolve. But one of the reasons, so let's back up a bit. Because there was one very small group of sawflies which did evolve the ability to be carnivorous. But they never really speciated. There aren't very many species of them. They're still extant today, so you'll find species of them, but there aren't that many of them. Whereas the parasitoid wasps is about 80,000 species, 70 to 80,000 species of parasitoid wasps. And those it became carnivorous. And so it can't just be carnivory that enabled those species to diversify. It must be something else, which brings us back to this wasp waste. So sawflies are quite stumpy looking. They haven't got that sort of delicate waist, and their ovipositors are quite rigid. They have to sort of saw, as the name suggests, saw into bark or wood to get their egg inside the plant. Whereas parasitoid wasps have this beautiful, long, thin, constricted waist, which allows their abdomen to bend underneath or bend and contort into all sorts of kind of yoga style moves. And that enables them to get their egg into much more difficult positions, which means that possibly they were able to exploit a really wide source of prey, which the carnivorous sawflies couldn't do. So we think that the wasp waste has been instrumental in the diversification, the speciation of the wasps, because it enabled them to exploit all these different prey resources.
What do we know about wasp intelligence?
Oh, wasp intelligence, right. Well, not a huge amount. Well, actually, so there's a lovely story. One of the old books that I've been reading as part of my book is the British scientist who was actually Darwin's neighbour, Lubbock, Sir John Lubbock, and he was Darwin's neighbour. And he used to run these very lovely little experiments in his house, and he had these two a room with like windows on two sides. And so he would put little offerings out. Did the same with bees. He'd put little offerings out and see, when a bee came, he'd mark it, and then he'd see if she came back again. And he did the same with wasps. And he had this lovely little. I mean, it's an anecdote. It's not an experiment, but it was possibly the first indication that wasps are quite clever. Is that he put a bee in a glass bottle, and then he held the bottle up against the open window such that the open end of the bottle was facing into the room and away from the window. And the bees, bless them, they couldn't find their way out. They just fly towards the light, and of course they kept hitting the end of the bottle. And he did the same experiment with wasps, and they immediately found their way out. They immediately went out the exit of the bottle. So I think that's a nice little, I mean, there's a reasons why that happens, because obviously wasps go to dark places to hunt, whereas bees go to light places to forage. But I think it was the first little anecdote which suggests that wasps were pretty clever. And then there has been some other early studies by so Margaret Morley, who's also an American. She wrote a beautiful book called Wasps and Their Ways, and she has this, again, it's very anecdotal, but it's a very lovely read. And I think she was a school teacher, actually, yeah. And she has this lovely anecdote of she had a Vespulus, or a yellow jacket wasp colony, and she put a red bit of paper or card around the entrance. And when the wasps came back, they noticed that something was different, so they could tell that the color was different. And but eventually they learned, okay, that's my nest entrance. And then she moved the red bit of paper, the entrance, the red entrance, to be a meter away or so from the actual nest entrance, and the wasps went to the red paper rather than the actual nest entrance, because they'd learned to associate that color with the entrance of their nest. And then eventually they learned that actually, oh, that was not right, that's not where their nest is, and they go back to their nest. And she did this several times with different colors, and eventually the wasps just kind of threw their tarsi up in the air and said, we're not going to use color anymore, we're just going to remember, use other landmarks. And wasps are really, really visual organisms. They have to be, because they have to be good hunters. And to be a good hunter, you've got to find your prey. You've got to have really good vision. And so they use landmarks a lot. And so these solitary digger wasps have been studied quite a lot, in terms of, they will know where their burrow is if there's a stone to the left of it and there's a tree, 30 centimeters to the right. If you move the stone around, or you move other landmarks, they get confused and they have to reorientate. But they're clever enough to reorientate, so that's pretty good. So that's kind of the historical kind of intelligence. But I have to just mention some fantastic work being done by a North American scientist, Liz Tibbetts, who has been done some wonderful work showing that wasps, so paper wasps, have incredible abilities in terms of recognizing each other. So they use their facial markings to identify the different individuals on the nest, and they can also tell who is better at one thing than another, or who, so they can do what we call transitive inference. So you can say that if A is bigger than B, so sorry, if A is bigger than C and B is smaller than A, then you can tell that B is bigger than C. So it's kind of, inferring information based on learnt relationships. And wasps can do this too. So I mean, she's definitely put wasp intelligence on the map.
That was my guest, Sirian Sumner, professor of behavioral ecology at University College London and author of the book Endless Forms: The Secret World of Wasps. We just heard about wasps. Later we'll study flies, but now let's turn to bees. Most bees live for only a few weeks. In that time, they are constantly learning, making decisions about how to build honeycomb structures or where to forage, and then sharing what they learn with their colonies. Yes, they're hard workers, but mindless drones? They're anything but. Lars Chitka is professor of sensory and behavioral ecology at Queen Mary University of London and co-editor of Cognitive Ecology of Pollination. His book is called The Mind of a Bee. Let's listen to that conversation from August. Lars, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
We will start by noting there are more than 20,000 known species of bees in the world, some social, most not social. So we will be doing some generalizing in this conversation. Are there certain key characteristics all bees have in common?
Well, they all have a home which distinguishes them from other insects that might sort of aimlessly drift across the landscape. Many of these 20,000 plus species are solitary, unlike the more familiar social bees. And these solitary bees are invariably single mothers. So they build a nest by themselves for their offspring. But they do have a home, like a hive bee, like a bumblebee. They have a nest which they must remember the location of, because otherwise of course, if they forget where they come from, if they forget where they have laid their eggs, then all their efforts are lost, and so is their offspring.
They have forms of all the senses humans have, and also some that we lack, right? What do we know about the function of bees' internal magnetic compass?
So you're right. The sensory world of bees is entirely different from the one that's familiar to us, and that includes the more familiar senses, such as color vision, for example. Bees have color vision, but the colors they see are entirely different from the ones we see. So they can see ultraviolet light, to which we are blind. We get sunburn from it. We can't see it. And on the other end of the spectrum, they can't see red as far as we do. So their whole spectrum is shifted. They also, as you said, have some sensory modalities that we just don't have, such as a magnetic compass sense. And that, of course, is very useful when you have to navigate over long distances, and not always is the sun available as a compass cue. And inside the hive, where it's often entirely dark, the compass sense can also help.
I have to admit, Lars, until I read your book, I had never considered the sort of puzzle box challenge that bees face every time they come upon a new flower species. Help us understand how plants kind of conceal nectar in ways that require the bees to go deep down within them and ideally pick up some pollen and take it elsewhere.
So that's, it's not all flowers that use these tricks. There are some flowers, such as, let's say, daisies, that are relatively openly accessible, and all kinds of pollinators, including flies and moths and butterflies and various species of bees, can land on them and basically just insert their tongues and extract nectar. But some flowers, they limit the kinds of pollinators that can access them. And there's a reason for that, because obviously, flowers are essentially plants' sex organs. They can't move to their partners because they're obviously stationary. And so they employ pollinators as vectors, as transport vehicles for their pollen. And obviously, the member of every plant species has an interest to that the pollen is only delivered to flowers of the same species, not all over the place to other flower species where the pollen material would simply be wasted. And so some flowers, such as snapdragons, are relatively complex structures where the bee has difficulty finding its way in, and also where it has to learn how to pry petals apart, either vertically or horizontally, and often has to deliver fairly advanced contortions to get to the nectar or pollen rewards. And so these flowers are essentially forcing the bees to specialize, to become experts in handling just these flowers. And once the bees have learned that, they will find a relatively rich nectar reward because other bees or other pollinators can't as easily access that. So the pollinators then become faithful to that one plant species that they have learned how to manipulate properly and stay faithful customers to that particular plant species. But for that, the requirement is that the bee needs to learn how to manipulate the flower and then becomes an expert in juggling just the mechanisms of that particular plant species.
Just to digress for a moment here, I finally understand something that has baffled me for years. Here in Texas, we've been told that if we plant milkweed, it's really good because certain butterflies can really only feed on milkweed. And I didn't know if there was a special substance in milkweed, but now I'm thinking maybe it's the structure of the flowers, and butterflies can't necessarily get into a lot of other flowers that other insects might feed on.
That's a possibility. Now, it has to be said that some pollinator species also have fairly tight innate preferences for just certain types of flowers. And with milkweed, it might well be, I think it's for monarch butterflies.
Yes.
It might well be that certain species of pollinators, just like these particular flowers, and are relatively tightly linked to them. That also exists in some species of bees, that there are relatively narrow specialists on certain flower species. But the specialization that I just referred to is a learned specialization, is one where on a species level, a certain species of bumblebee or honeybee can in principle learn all kinds of different flower mechanisms, but as individuals, they specialize in a limited number because they've learned how to best exploit these flowers and manipulate these puzzle boxes, as we've called them.
How do individual foraging bees, perhaps leaving their colonies with lots of their peers, carve out like distinct daily routes for themselves so that they're not all just swarming toward the closest flower?
So they either explore the environment by themselves, or they inform themselves on the dance floor from other bees about useful food sources that are out there at the moment. So most bees start their outside hive behavior with some exploration. So there is a phase when they're exploring their environment where they don't necessarily visit too many flowers yet. They're just flying around in various directions, memorizing landmarks, memorizing the appearance of their native nest or their hive, and its location relative to conspicuous landmarks. And only after they've done that will they start to explore suitable food sources by sampling different flower species. But in addition to this individual exploration, which is of course time costly and risky, because you might spend a lot of time trying different flower species or patches that have already been depleted or are just not valuable. In addition to this individual exploration, at least in honeybees that have this elaborate communication system, they can visit the area inside the hive where the dancers are displayed, the dance floor, if you wish, to look for information there and then follow up on that by simply flying directly to a destination that they have been told about by a dancing bee.
This is really remarkable, Lars. Bees can be trained to recognize individual human faces?
Indeed, they can. So we, again, essentially use the reward technique that bees naturally expose themselves to when they're learning flowers to let them learn all kinds of things, including the appearance of individual images of individual human faces. So what we did in that case was simply attach a little landing platform for a bee in front of a black and white photograph of a bee, of a human. And if they've picked the correct face, then they get a little nectar reward and then fly home and come back to our setup. And then basically in a variation of sort of classical crime witness test, we remove the reward and give the bees a choice between a variety of different faces. And of course, they have to be spatially shuffled, so they can't just fly back to the location where they'd previously been rewarded. And it turns out that the bees can indeed, with 80% certainty, pick the correct face on which they had previously been rewarded, even though the reward is now no longer present. So they really use the appearance of the face to identify the correct one.
Wow. How sensitive are bees to the temperature within flowers?
They are very sensitive to the temperature because it saves them energy to find warmer flowers. And one of the remarkable things about flowers is they don't just have color and scent cues, but they also have warmth, depending on how efficiently they capture sunlight. And that for bees, especially if they're foraging in colder habitats, if you're a bumblebee and foraging in some high altitude mountain environment and the air is cold, for bees, this has a function basically of of consuming a hot drink. It warms their bodies and they need warmth. They have a body temperature that's actually pretty close to our own when they're flying. And to keep that temperature costs a lot of energy. And if you can save energy by consuming a warmer drink, then of course you have to visit fewer flowers to obtain the same sort of nectar. And so bees are quite sensitive to picking out warmer flowers, even by a few degrees, when they have a choice between different flower types that differ in temperature.
How do bee colonies make, I guess, collective decisions to swarm to a new location and make their homes in a different place?
That is indeed a remarkable process in honeybees. So, unlike many other animals where the young leave the native home and find a new one, what happens in honeybees is that the old queen, together with some 10,000 experienced workers, leaves the native home and decides on a new one. And they have to decide together. The individual bee can't survive. The queen can't survive. They have to collectively arrive at a consensus. And what happens is that in a process that happens over several days, so first of all, the swarm leaves the native home, settles on a nearby tree, and then sends out scouts over a territory many miles across. These scouts inspect natural cavities, sometimes chimneys and so on, and inspect them by their cavities, by whether the size is suitable and the humidity and the entrance hole and so on, and then come back to the swarm to communicate again using the dance language where they've been. And initially, there's a great deal of controversy. Different bees have discovered different locations and they differ in their opinions, so to speak. So they advertise multiple locations. And then over a period of days, gradually, you can see that more and more individuals converge on the same opinion until all the dances are just for one location, and then the entire swarm lifts off and flies to the new location. So there's a form of democratic, if you wish, decision making where every vote to some extent is considered at some level. And finally, there is a unanimous decision on flying to one destination.
That must be an amazing thing to witness.
It is, I mean, a bee swarm is something absolutely magnificent to observe. And remarkably, what happens there is that there's no one who counts the votes. There is no central overseer of the process who at the end says, "All right, I've heard all of your opinions and now I decide on one thing." It's an entirely decentralized process where bees that have found a better location advertise it for a longer duration. They dance for longer periods. And that means any bee randomly stumbling around on the swarm has a higher chance of bumping into a scout bee that has good information than a bee that has poor information. And so these bees then attending the dances check out the location themselves, come back to the swarm, and will again then advertise it for a longer duration if it's been a good one. And so the entire process snowballs until one unanimous decision is reached, but without anyone counting votes or making a final decision in the process.
You really feel like we have an obligation as humans to make sure that bees continue to survive and thrive. Are there particular things that we've learned about bees' minds that might make the case for conservation to people who haven't cared so much about them before?
I think so. I mean, I think many people are now aware that we need to conserve bees because they feed us, because they pollinate our crops, because every third bite we eat depends on bee pollination. But I think that the observation that bees are most likely sentient beings, however simple their minds are, but there seem to be simple emotional states in them. There is a remarkable form of intelligence that extends way beyond just semi-innate behaviors, at least such as comb construction. But they can solve simple problems by thinking rather than by trial and error, as we found in our tool use experiments. And I think We owe these strange minds, these alien minds, if you wish, some respect, and we need to conserve the environments that have shaped them, I think.
Lars Chitka is professor of sensory and behavioral ecology at Queen Mary University of London and co-editor of Cognitive Ecology of Pollination. His book is called The Mind of a Bee. Let's turn our attention now to flies. There are 160,000 known species of flies, including fruit flies, house flies, gnats, and every kind of mosquito. And by some estimates, there are 17 quadrillion individual flies alive on Earth at any given moment. And while it's true, some of them bite and spread diseases, and lots of them gross us out, my guest says we should not overlook the fact that life as we know it would not be possible without flies. Jonathan Balcom is a biologist, researcher, and educator. His book is called Superfly, The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. Let's listen to our conversation from 2021. Jonathan, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris.
When you define flies as successful, what does that mean exactly?
The sheer numbers of individual flies, most of which are probably larvae at any one time, but also and the number of species you mentioned, 160,000 known. I'm glad you said known, because it's estimated by entomologists, people who study insects, that there's probably close to five times as many species of flies as the number, as that number, 160,000. It's just they haven't been found or described yet.
Wow. And they don't live long, but they reproduce at an almost inconceivable rate. Can you like walk us through how many flies can exist within a few generations?
Yeah, I remember reading in the introduction to an entomology book when I was an undergraduate biology student and just being completely bowled over by some math that somebody did. It was a hypothetical situation, thank goodness, taking two fruit flies on January 1st of an imaginary year. And in 1 year, fruit flies can produce 25 generations. And if you take all of the flies from just generation 25, not counting all the other ones before that, if each female lays 100 eggs, half of them on average are males and half on females are females. So you do the math for the 25th generation alone. If you packed those flies very densely into a ball, that ball would reach from here to the sun and a little bit beyond. So about 93 million miles, if I remember correctly.
Wow. And the reason that we are not just straight flies from here to the sun is because a lot of those larvae don't mature, right? They don't all survive.
Checks and balances. That's right. Yeah, nature has checks and balances. A lot of creatures eat flies or their eggs or their larvae. And so right off the bat, not all of the ones are going to survive the first generation, and that affects all the subsequent generations. I think it's safe to say that any fly you see that's an adult fly with wings flying around or trotting around on your fruit bowl, that fly was a lottery winner, because there's a lot of ways that flies get winnowed out of the population before that stage.
But they can live on every continent, including Antarctica. How do they not freeze to death?
You know, I'm not actually sure the answer to that. They may have natural antifreeze. Certainly some animals do. But it's important. It's very good that they can tolerate colder temperatures than most other insects, because that makes them the champion pollinators of plants at high altitudes and high latitudes. The bees, which are the number one ranking pollinators, flies are next in line. The bees just can't tolerate those cold temperatures. So thank goodness for flies.
I loved reading about the pollination thing. And I'm embarrassed to say I reached the age I am without really knowing about this. I was on vacation last week in a place with tons of flowers. And for the first time, I paid attention to all the flies on flowers, because usually you look for the bees and the butterflies to sort of admire them. And then you see a fly and you think, what is that doing there? Get back to your dirty old hot dog or whatever you want to be on. But they're huge pollinators.
I'm touched that you looked for flies.
I did.
And it's true. It's true that if you don't look closely, they're easily overlooked. I actually paid a visit to the insectarium in Montreal while I was researching this book. And in the lobby, they had a very nice display on champion pollinators, I think they called it. And there were about 45 insects identified. Most of them were bees and wasps, maybe some butterflies, because we all love looking at them. Not a single fly was among them, and yet flies are critical pollinators. They're, as I said earlier, they're ranked second only to the bees and wasps. So we have a lot to thank them for in that department.
Specifically, no flies, no chocolate?
Well, apparently, as far as is known, there's only one known insect with the ability to pollinate the devilishly hard to get in at chocolate, or rather cocoa flower. And it's a very complex flower with narrow niches, I suppose. And these tiny, there's a tiny, very unspectacular midge, which has been dubbed the chocolate midge because it's the only known insect able to pollinate the cacao plant, which leads to the main ingredient for chocolate. So, yeah, thanks to them.
I did not realize there are species of flies, or at least one, that can live underwater, not just go in the water, but live in the water.
That's right. Mark Twain wrote with passion about meeting this fly, and this fly is able to sort of burrow into the surface of the water, and with a combination of oils and bristles on its body that helps to capture a bubble of air. So the fly then can swim his or her way down to the bottom of this particular lake. And can run around on the bottom, feeding on algae and whatever else they feed on. The tips of their legs and their mouth parts are conveniently able to emerge from the bubble, so they can carry out this foraging behavior underwater. And then they pop up to the surface again, as Twain put it, as dry as a patent report.
So while we're at it, what makes an insect a fly and not a beetle or a wasp or an ant?
I'm glad you asked that, because it is a little confusing. I mean, they're true insects, so they have six legs. But unlike the other flying insects, they only have two wings. But it may be with the simplicity of having the two wings that maybe lends itself to their being such accomplished flyers. You know, when you consider a housefly can do a little flip and land on a ceiling and then trot along the ceiling. And some flies can beat their wings at over 1,000 times per second. That would be a small fly. And so they are remarkably adept at flying and maneuvering.
All right, I want to talk about fly eyesight. Males in a lot of fly species have what's called holoptic vision. What does that mean?
Kind of like sense around. There's a picture of a big-headed fly in my book, and it's just an amazing fly to look at. It's small and an incredibly good flyer, but the males have, it looks like, it reminds me of the nose of a traditional clown, that big bulbous red nose stuck on the head of this fly, stuck over the head. The whole head looks like these two red eyes, which are surrounding the head, so it almost kind of looks like one single eye. This gives them the ability to obviously see in all kind of angles, in front, above, below, behind, which is very useful for avoiding danger, but also if you're a male, and the males have this characteristic to spot and pursue a tempting female during reproductive time.
So why would females have dicoptic vision, which does not sort of go all the way around?
It's a great question. I don't have a patent answer to that. I would say it's once again back to checks and balances. Their need to find mates, males are going to come to them, so they don't need to perhaps have such good vision. But having smaller eyes, which is to say perhaps smaller heads as well, gives them a little bit more flight maneuverability. So there's probably benefits to them not evolving those big eyes that the males have.
It seems to us like flies will eat anything, particularly whatever is gross to us. But they actually, this was so interesting to me, they do taste tests before they fill up on something. So how does a fly do a taste test?
Well, a fly does a taste test as soon as they land on the potential food item, be it your arm or a dog turd or a flower. They have sensors, taste sensors in their feet and actually on their wings in some cases and other parts of their body. So they're able to immediately get a read on what they're on. And it's a very quick and convenient way to sample a potential food source without wasting too much time.
So are they sampling to make sure it's not somehow toxic to them, or just to make sure that it's something that they can eat?
In the case of fruit flies, which go after fruit, and particularly rotting fruit, a byproduct of which is alcohol and from fermentation, in some situations, fruit flies will gravitate to the alcohol. This, for instance, is a way of what's called self-medication. It meets the criteria, scientific criteria, for self-medication. That is to say, the flies deliberately go for the alcohol if they are being threatened or infected by parasitic wasps who may lay eggs in them. This could be the larvae of the fly that gets an egg laid in them. And by consuming the alcohol, it's toxic to the egg of the wasp, or the parasitic wasp. So it may act as a preventative and B, a treatment for these parasitic wasps. So it is a true example of self-medication in an insect.
Okay, so self-medication, does that imply that they know what they're doing or that they have some instinct when they are threatened in this way?
Yeah, tough question. How do you know? I can tell you that flies do have minds, that they have brains, differentiated brains with different parts for learning and memory, spatial information, organizing movement, connecting brain regions and collecting sensory information, for instance. There's different names for different parts of the brain for doing those types of tasks. So they do seem to have an awareness. There's other evidence about cognition, thinking, rational decision making, etc. in flies and in insects in general. So it's quite reasonable to suggest that a fly goes after alcohol with purpose, with intent.
Wow. So the fact that flies sleep, what does that suggest about their capacity for intelligence?
Well, if you ever watch a fly, they sure seem to be living in the fast lane. Their wakeful times are very active, and they're on the go, and they've got enemies, so they need to be quick to try and escape. So it probably gets exhausting. And at the end of a day of being a fly, they probably need to take a nap. I actually describe a fruit fly trap, an ingenious I'll call it a humane trap, that one can put in their kitchen. And I see the flies sometimes inside this trap animatedly flipping their wings around, probably courting others. They can do their whole life history in this little trap, which is a little plastic container with some bits of peach or banana or rotting fruit that they go for. And you cover it up with cellophane or in a baggie, and then you poke a few tiny holes with the tip of a sharp knife, and these enterprising little creatures will find their way in. They can detect the scent gradient, the chemical gradient from the fruit wafting out through these holes. And it's remarkable to watch, but they're very busy during the day, and yet you can look at them at night and they're usually just sitting there still. So they're kind of having nap time.
Why do flies do this weird thing? When you're watching them close up, they'll sort of rub their front limbs together like a Batman villain who's just set some kind of trap. What are they doing when they make that gesture?
I always think they look like a gourmand who's getting ready for a meal.
Oh.
And in fact, maybe I'm a little closer than you in that score, because as we know, that flies that can taste through their feet. So by continually or often rubbing the feet together, it's one possible reason for that is that it's cleaning off any residue from previous meals and making the taste buds all fresh and ready to detect the presence of something new. So it's a little bit like the fly equivalent of us clearing our palate before the next bite.
Jonathan, should we be thinking about the ethical implications of using millions upon millions of these animals for lab research? I mean, we worry about how it might feel for a rat or a rabbit in a lab or an octopus. Do flies suffer being used as test subjects?
There is evidence for hypersensitivity, long-term pain in flies that have been experimentally had a leg amputated, for instance. 3 weeks later, they show a hypersensitivity to, say, heat pain that an unamputated fly doesn't show. This is, for instance, putting them on a hot plate. It's a temperature that is sort of approaching the tolerance limit for a fly. The one who's had an injury a few weeks earlier runs off that hot plate at a lower temperature than unaffected flies. So that's an example of the type of approach now that scientists are actually, it's interesting that a scientist is actually asking questions about pain and attention spans and decision making and what we broadly call cognition. But we've known about the honeybee waggle dance for decades now, and how complex that is. Symbolic language. So these are other insects, and insects are, as we look closer, they're so much more complex than we thought they were.
Your personal rule is to only kill flies in self-defense. What does that mean to you, self-defense?
Well, if I'm out hiking and the mosquitoes are having at me, sometimes I'll give them a second chance, swat them off, you know, just brush them off. But if they're persistent, I know why they're there. I know they're after my blood. So I think it's fair enough to defend in that case. But proactive killing, I much prefer to let a bunch of fruit flies out into the yard after catching them in my handy little kitchen fly trap than I do to swat them or to smash them. I feel like I'm liberating a little bit of my soul when I let them go outside.
That was biologist Jonathan Balcom, author of Superfly, The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. We also heard this hour from Sarian Sumner, author of Endless Forms, The Secret World of Wasps, and Lars Chitka, author of The Mind of a Bee. You can listen to the extended versions of today's conversations at our website, think.kera.org, where you can also find out about upcoming shows and subscribe to our new newsletter. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for KERA Think and subscribe to our podcast for free wherever you get your podcasts. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.